Hello, this is Terrence McNally. It's 10 years since the financial crash of 2008. I see books and articles and commentators looking back. So let's listen to my conversation with Michael Lewis. Recorded in April 2010, we talk about his number one bestseller, The Big Short. But more than that, I ask him to define terms like securitization, derivatives, credit default swaps. It's one of my all-time favorite interviews.
I saw Ira Glass's live one-man show, he calls it Radio Stories, this past weekend. And when he was asked in the Q&A session his favorite current storyteller, he answered Michael Lewis. Malcolm Gladwell calls Lewis, quote, the finest storyteller of our generation. In his Washington Post review, Stephen Perlstein writes, if you read only one book about the causes of the recent financial crisis, let it be Michael Lewis's The Big Short. So what I like is someone who is praised by storytellers as a storyteller, then puts that talent into the pursuit of telling stories that matter. Lewis was a trader at Salomon Brothers before he wrote his first bestseller, Liar's Poker, about the excesses of Wall Street during the 1980s. And on Freeform, we've talked to many people about the recent financial meltdown. Krugman, Stiglitz, Grider, Baker, Reich, and more. Today, we turn to Michael Lewis. His approach in The Big Short varies from all the others in that he focuses on a few mavericks who saw what others denied and made fortunes shorting the biggest bets by the biggest players on Wall Street and beyond. On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Michael Lewis received a BA in art history from Princeton, a master's in economics from the London School of Economics. His books include Moneyball, The Blind Side, Panic, The Story of Modern Financial Insanity, and his newest, The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine. Welcome back, Michael Lewis, to Free Forum.
Happy to be back.
Yeah. You've said that, and you said it earlier, but you've said it a lot lately. You've said that when you wrote Liar's Poker, you thought you were writing about the end of something, and it turns out more like the beginning. You even say that the roots of the recent meltdown, some of them were planted in that period. How so?
If you look at the recent meltdown, you see that it is a problem of really bad incentives on Wall Street, that people were incentivized not to see simple facts in front of their nose and not to act in even their own firm's long-term interests. And the question is sort of how that happened. And I think the answer dates back to really when I was on the trading floor at Salomon Brothers, I mean, in the mid-1980s. If you want to kind of find an original sin on Wall Street, I think it's the sale of these partnerships, these old Wall Street partnerships, to the public in the form of public corporations.
You know, I think one thing that might be a surprise to people nowadays is that as recently as the 80s, that these were private partnerships.
Yes. And in fact, there was a general understanding that if you were going to take this sort of financial risk, the best form to take it in was a partnership, because then it was the people taking the risk had their own money on the line. They were liable if the firm went down, personally liable. They would lose their homes, and that encouraged a different sort of attitude towards the taking of risk. They were just much less likely to take it. And then when all of a sudden they're playing with shareholders' money, it becomes an entirely different thing. It becomes a matter of kind of heads I win, tails shareholders lose. And you saw the changes that happened in these big Wall Street firms, and they're radically different places than they were 30 years ago, began then. And they began actually first at Salomon Brothers. Salomon Brothers became the model for what, say, Goldman Sachs is today in many ways. And the big change is the drift away from servicing customers, from being essentially handmaiden to productive enterprise, to being essentially traders of their own accounts, to being their own speculators in the market. And to the point where even by the time I left the street, I was working at a firm that had, I don't know, 8,000 employees, And there were years where more than 100% of the profits were generated by five so-called proprietary traders taking massive bets. So the rest of the firm was unprofitable, and they were making these huge speculative bets that determined the fate of the firm for the year. And this obviously changed the relationship of the firms to their customers. They became less and less interested in their relationships with their customers and more interested in how their bets turned out. And even if those bets were at the expense of their customers, the bets became the big thing.
Yeah. And it's interesting also, I mean, not interesting, looking back at this evolution, it's frightening that they go from partnerships under a lot of regulation to public companies, which gives them the certain freedom you've just described, and then the regulation gets weakened as well.
Yes, the regulation gets weakened to the point where the most important parts of the enterprise are virtually unregulated. You have the invention of a market called the credit default swaps market, which is essentially a market inside bets on the securities. So instead of buying or selling a subprime mortgage bond, you make side bets in the form of credit default swaps, insurance policies on those bonds, and that those side bets were entirely unregulated. So the sums involved were essentially unknown to the authorities when Lehman Brothers fails in September of 2008, and no one knows how many of the things are out there.
Right.
It's also sort of generally true that the energy that has gone into regulating Wall Street has been largely focused on the stock market, because that's where a lot of little people are, and that's where the votes are. And the stock market in America is now dwarfed in significance by the bond markets, by the debt markets, by the lending that goes on. We've got indebtedness at every level of the society. That indebtedness finds its way into bonds, corporate bonds, subprime mortgage bonds, government bonds. And the bond market is the Wild West. I mean, the SEC doesn't have the first clue what's going on inside the bond market. And it is far, far easier to get ripped off if you're an investor in the bond market than the stock market. And so I think what's happened is there's some basic sea changes what actually happens in the financial world without any equivalent sea change in the regulation.
Exactly. I would love it, although the distinction about your book, which I referred to, is that you trace it through characters, through a few mavericks and so on. Before we get into that story, I'm going to ask you one of the things that worked for me in that book was, one, I'm following these personal stories. So they're on a hunt, and I join them on the hunt. That great narrative trick, because I've had, as I said, all those great economists on, and in some sense, none of them have explained things quite as well. So while I'm learning about Eisman or Burry, I'm learning about credit default swaps.
Right.
When they need a CDO, a collateralized debt obligation to now get out of the hole they've created, then you reveal that and so on. So having said that, still, what I would love you to do is I'm going to ask you to explain in layman's terms, and in this case—
I always start to shudder when the question, all right, what would you like me to explain? I'll do my best.
I'm going to give you a list.
All right.
And by layman's, we don't mean Lehman Brothers.
Right.
simple one. What's a hedge fund?
A hedge fund is, it's a— an investment company. It's a company that takes other people's money and invests it in the markets. And it's a far less regulated investment fund. Typically, the people who invest in hedge funds are big institutions or very rich people. And the typical hedge fund, I think, has to have 99 or fewer investors to remain unregulated or unregulated as a hedge fund. A hedge fund can also do things that say the typical mutual fund cannot do. It can bet against the price of shares and bonds as well as bet on them. So it can sell short. And initially, the reason it was called a hedge fund was that it was they could
hedge your bet.
Hedge your bet. That's right. But beyond that, hedge funds, there are so many different kinds of hedge funds, it's a little hard to define them. They're hedge funds that specialize in doing nothing but betting in the U.S. stock market. They're hedge funds that will bet on everything that goes on in the world. So they define themselves to their investors, and they're supposed to sort of stick to their mission. They're supposed to, if they say, I am going to be what's called a long short equity fund. That's probably the most common kind of fund. And what long short equity fund is doing is they are saying, say they're buying buying shares of Chevron at the same time they're betting against the shares of Exxon. So they're not, in that case, they're not exposed really to which way the stock market goes. They're betting on the price differential between two companies in the oil industry. So if I say that's what I am, I'm not allowed to go, I don't know, you know, bet against the subprime mortgage market, for example. So each hedge fund's a little different, a little hard beyond the general description to pin
but
them
that,
down.
That's helpful. Okay, and I'm starting with the ones that people have heard about for years. Derivatives. What makes something a derivative?
Literally, it's derived. It's a security that's derived from whose value is derived from the value of other securities, which is already it's an abstraction on an abstraction. But before they were they'll make it easier. Before they were called derivatives, and this is actually what I did when I was at Salomon Brothers. They didn't call them derivatives at the time, but I was the derivative specialist for their London office. They were called futures and options.
Sure.
Those were kinds of derivatives. So a pork belly future. You're betting on the future price of pork bellies without actually having to deal in the pork bellies themselves.
You don't need a stock car to show up somewhere to do it.
Only if you happen to hold on to this contract until the future becomes the present. But you can bet on the price of pork bellies through the futures market or an option. An option is an insurance policy. Basically, it's the right, if you're buying one, it's the right to buy or sell something, a currency, a commodity, a stock, a bond, at a given price for a fixed period of time. If you're selling it, you're selling the insurance. You're selling.
So you're locking in a price without committing to buy it.
Yeah. So you're paying a premium.
You're paying something for the right to pay the price you set today.
So I might pay you, I don't know, if you're selling the options, I might pay you $5 for the right to buy Exxon shares at a price of $70 a share anytime in the next 6 months. And that's obviously, if Exxon shares bouncing around a lot, it's obviously a very valuable thing. If Exxon shares is somehow written, the price is written in stone and will never move, and it's below 70, then it's not a very valuable thing. Those are the original derivatives. These most derivatives all derivatives are some permutation on options and futures.
Great. This is the voice of Michael Lewis. I'm Terrence McNally. We're actually laying down some groundwork. As I've asked to do, but we're ultimately talking about the...
What you're doing is you're reverse engineering my book. That you're taking what is supposed to be a ripping yarn, and it's a tale that people want to read and never notice that they're learning what an option is in the bargain, and turning it into an academic textbook. That's all right. Go ahead.
On the other hand, I'm proving to them that this guy who gets kudos as a storyteller does know what he's talking about.
Up to a point. I know what I have to know, and it's sort of need to know
when
basis.
You have to know it.
If it's outside the confines of my story, I try not to learn it.
That seems wise.
I don't want to clutter my brain.
Securitization. And this was, now we're getting, I mean, the first two sort of begin because hedge funds are less regulated, derivatives are more abstract. We're beginning to get in dangerous territory. Once we start in a securitization, we're edging towards danger.
Well, this shouldn't be that complicated because the securitization is something that is at the heart of Liar's Poker, which is my original book about Wall Street. It is what happened in the 80s and transformed Wall Street. But it is taking a loan. So a bank makes a loan to you to buy a house. That gives you a mortgage. What used to happen is that bank or savings and loan would have to just sit on that loan, and it would be exposed to you either paying it off or not paying it off, or perhaps paying it off prematurely. And so it had to know all about you, and it had to evaluate the risk of you.
This is the old model of Bedford Falls and George Bailey.
Exactly.
Investing.
This is
the
way
folks.
Loans get made for forever until really the late 1970s, early 1980s, for consumer loans. And at which point, at Salomon Brothers, was invented the mortgage-backed security, the mortgage-backed bond. This is a securitization where they would take a pile of loans, thousands of you, and they would buy the loans from the bank. And because the loans are worth something, because you're gonna be making your house payments, and there's gonna be a cash flow coming in, and then they would bundle them up together, these loans, and sell them off as a piece of paper in the form of a bond to someone anywhere in the world, and that person might be, I don't know, a banker in Germany or Japan, and they would own a mortgage bond, and they wouldn't know who you were or where you were. They would just know that this mortgage bond got a rating. From Moody's or Standard & Poor, one of the ratings agencies, and that rating told them roughly how risky it was. And
roughly how risky that one was, or roughly how risky the pile they just bought were?
How risky the pile they just bought was. Right, the pile is the bond.
Right.
So
The pile of loans becomes a bond.
Right.
The bond gets rated.
And the way the bond works is, I mean, this is where it gets a little complicated, but if you just stop and slowly think about it, it isn't that complicated. So you got thousands of loans underneath underneath these bonds. And some of the loans are going to go bad. Some of them are going to pay off or repay early. The cash flows that come into that, essentially this pool of loans, is uncertain. And so what they do, this is where the word tranche comes in. I'll save you the trouble of really, really driving your audience back to wherever they came from. What they say is they tranche it up, they slice it up, and they say, okay, this is this pile of loans. If you're going to buy a bond that's secured by this pile of loans, you can buy in different flavors. You can buy the riskiest. The first losses that come in, the first people who don't pay off,
and
you
by the
can
way,
suffer them.
I just want to make sure I'm getting this right. On either one of the buyers or the seller in this one, doesn't have to know who that's going to be. They don't even have to predict who that's going to be. It just means that the first that default.
Yes.
Good.
That's right.
So there's no prediction in that.
No,
it's just,
it doesn't matter who defaults.
Right?
It just means that that this trust that is a collection of loans, it starts to experience losses. You, the buyer of the lowest rated bonds, the riskiest bonds, will suffer that. In exchange, you'll get a higher interest payment on your bond. And on the, conversely, it's pretty certain that at least some of the people whose loans are in this trust are going to pay off their loans. And so at the other end of the spectrum, you, the nervous Nelly bond buyer, you buy the highest rated bond that gets the last of the – that gets the first of the payments. And as a result, you have the lowest interest rate. You get paid the least return for owning that bond. So the original story on Wall Street, and it was a true story, was that by securitizing loans, by turning piles of loans into bonds and selling them off all over the world, you were able to attract capital from all over the world to places where you couldn't previously attract it. So if you lived in Los Angeles, California, you were previously at the mercy of lenders in Los Angeles, California. And now, all of a sudden, anybody in the world could essentially make you the loan.
At one remove,
or maybe more than one remove.
Yeah, right.
And so the effect of this is going to be to lower the increased demand for these loans in the form of bonds is going to lower the cost to the borrower. And this is, in fact, what happened. And in the first approximation, all of these loans, though, were to prime borrowers, to borrowers who had high credit scores, whose loans could be rubber-stamped by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, one of the government-sponsored agencies. And so your loan was effectively government-guaranteed. What happened first, briefly and in small numbers in the 1990s, and then very recently, was that the loans began to be made to people with very low credit scores, who were much riskier borrowers, called subprime borrowers, and to a market that had basically not, it certainly didn't exist when I was on Wall Street, but became a multi-trillion-dollar market in the mid-2000s.
Right. So securitization, this bundling of individual loans, and since then, it's happened. They also bundle individual credit card accounts and individual student loans.
Well,
if
you back away from it, anything that has a cash flow, you could bundle health club dues.
Sure.
Anything where in which you have promised to make payments over some period of time could be securitized, and it has been.
And so that innovation at first, as you point out, was kind of good for everybody.
Yeah.
It kept the cash flowing. It lowered the price to borrow, et cetera, et cetera. The problem was when some brainy guy realized that since I'm selling them off right away.
Yes. Yes. Well, so here's what happened.
And this is Michael Lewis, author of The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday
Machine.
Here's
what happened. In the first place, an argument was made on Wall Street. It was a self-serving argument. It was that Wall Street makes its money by creating new markets that are essentially inefficient markets, where you're the person who creates them has a brief monopoly. And then everybody rushes in and drives down the returns and they move on. Well, the innovation that occurred in the mid-90s was to say, well, we've created this market for prime mortgage loans, turning them into bonds. What if we start lending to other sorts of people where there's an actual risk they're not going to repay? And this was thought to be of some social utility because the borrowers, the American middle and lower middle class, was going further and further into debt. This was actually in response to a hollowing out of the manufacturing economy and piling up lots of credit card debt. Credit card debt is high interest rate debt, right? If you're in hock to your Visa card, it's, you know, you're paying what, 25%, 30% annual interest. And the argument was how good it would be for these people, if instead of owing the money to the credit card company, they used this one asset they had, their house that they owned in which they had equity, to borrow against the asset. And it was so therefore secured against the value of the house, and the interest payments would be lower. And so thus was born the subprime mortgage bond business. And the people who were making the loans all were required to keep, or they all by market convention anyway, were kept some exposure to the loans. So they might sell off 90% of the loans, but they retained some ownership, some skin in the game. And in fact, this is what doomed them. The loans go bad, and they all went out of business. Now, what occurred?
Oh, so this is what you're saying.
This is in the 90s.
This is in the 90s.
And this is an early experiment with
Subprime. This is not Citibank. This is not Lehman Brothers.
This is an early iteration of becomes a monster.
Of what becomes Countrywide.
That's right. Because the lesson that was learned was not don't make subprime mortgage loans. The lesson that was learned was don't keep skin in the game. and so when they come roaring back in the 2000s, these firms are making loans and selling off everything. And so securitization, what it ends up happening is it ends up creating this hazard in the market that the person who's making the loan to you, who knows you, who can look in your eye and see what kind of guy you are, who can evaluate, there's all this information you acquire when you know a person.
That's always been the
way lending took place.
One of the currencies of lending.
It involved individual judgments of character.
Within a community,
all that, all that information gets completely lost. It just gets lost. It's lost. And instead, if the loan can be sold on to someone who doesn't know you, and then sold on and sold on and sold on, in the end, there's so much distance. Securitization enables there to be so much distance between ultimate lender and ultimate borrower that there's none of that evaluation going on. And this is the beginning of this disaster we went through. And the question is, why does it happen? Well, it happens because essentially, Wall Street firms figure out how much money there is to be made from making these loans and being the intermediary, and creating these bonds and selling them on. And they, of course, they have a problem that these loans are risky.
And getting riskier.
And getting riskier. But they essentially build a machine to disguise the risk. From the ultimate investor. But it makes it sound like it's purely willful, more complicated than that. They end up disguising the risk from themselves.
That's the ultimate.
It all gets so complicated that they end up owning a whole bunch of this stuff that they created that's a disaster.
The next two terms I was going to ask are the ones that they're now inventing, which is the credit default swaps and then the collateralized debt obligation.
Yes. Well, a credit default swap is it's a form of an option. It's an insurance policy. And you up until 2005, it was impossible, technically impossible, to bet against the price of subprime mortgage bonds. In order to bet against the price of, say, a stock, which you can do, you need to be able to borrow the stock. Because what you do, the technique you use, you borrow you know, I don't know, say you think Exxon shares are going to fall. You pay a fee to someone who owns Exxon shares to borrow the shares to sell them. And you're betting that you can buy them back at a lower price later. It's called shorting. You couldn't short subprime mortgage bonds because each bond was peculiar and actually in very small amounts. You couldn't find them. So they weren't shortable. So what gets invented to enable the market to bet against subprime mortgage bonds is something called a credit default swap. And in the credit default swap, say you're Goldman Sachs now. You're no longer the mortgage borrower. I will come to you, Goldman Sachs, and I will say, I want to bet against this mortgage bond. I want to bet those loans aren't going to pay off. And Goldman Sachs would run some numbers through its machine and they'd say, okay, you have to pay 2% a year premium in order to do that. You're buying an insurance policy. And if you're right and the bonds go completely to zero, you make 100. So, and that's roughly the price at which these credit default swaps traded. So it was a 50-to-1 bet kind of thing. That's where the credit default swap is an instrument. It's an insurance policy on a security.
Right.
And let me just, I
still want to get to collateralized debt obligation because that's the next thing. But as Joseph Stiglitz, sitting in that same chair a couple of weeks ago, said, the difference is, of course, that in the insurance industry, you have to have the capital to meet if you're selling the insurance,
you have to have you're regulated by
if
insurance.
If you've got fire insurance on the house, you got to have enough money to cover that house if it burns down.
Yes.
This was not true in these quote insurance policies.
Yeah, there are other things that weren't true about these insurance policies. I can't buy fire insurance on your house, and I can buy fire insurance on your house in the financial markets. And there's no limit to how much I can buy. So it is as if. Say I identified a neighborhood in Los Angeles that looked like it was susceptible to arson, and there was $10 million worth of property there. And not only could I go and buy $10 million worth of fire insurance on that, I could buy $1 trillion worth of fire insurance on that. So all of a sudden, I have a $1 trillion incentive to torch that neighborhood. You know, so that it creates, this is what got created, where it was a market inside bets on the securities, on the loans, that overwhelmed the actual loans.
And that's where when we begin, I mean, it's funny because 5-6 years ago, I was talking to real progressives who looked at the Wall Street and so on and called it a casino. But it was at this point when we're now making side bets that dwarf all the real tangible assets that are being traded, that it really becomes a casino.
Yes, no, and it's very funny how this happens, because in the beginning with financial innovation, there's always an argument why it's a good thing for society. And in the beginning, the credit default swap was argued to be a good thing because it would enable actual financial people to hedge their exposure. Now, it doesn't make actually a lot of sense when you think about it. If you were an owner of a subprime mortgage bond, you don't need to buy a credit default swap if you're afraid it's going to go down. You could just sell the subprime mortgage bond. And in fact, the hedging use of credit default swaps was trivial compared to just the gambling use. And what ended up happening was that the smart players in the market ended up identifying the absolute worst piles of subprime loans.
These are the people you feature in The Big Short.
Yes, others. And even traders in Goldman Sachs did this. And would identify the absolute worst piles.
The most likely to default.
And they would go and solicit. They would go and buy credit default swaps on those from people who were less well-informed, who were idiots to sell them. They were big Wall Street firms who were selling them. It is not inconceivable that there's some pile of loans that, say, was made in Irvine, California, or one of these hot centers where the real estate prices went crazy, that were especially bad loans, on which there might be 50 or 100 times the amount of the underlying loans inside bets. And over and over.
In other words, and this is one of the things that I first heard like a year ago, and I've been like, you know, it blows my mind every time. That's how when we began to hear that there were $62 trillion in credit default swaps outstanding in the world, and you go, well, how can there be when that's beyond the gross product of the world?
They could be, there's a theoretical unlimited number.
It could be infinite it's all about bets. If I wanted to bet on whether Peyton Manning was going to complete his next pass, And I could bet with everyone in the world on that. That's about as sane as this was, although you had a pretty good chance that Peyton Manning probably was going to complete his next pass.
Yes.
This was much more uncertain.
So what you think about what you create then you have, say you have a pile, the ultimate bond, say, is backed by 1,000 loans, and say that, just for fun, they usually aren't concentrated in just one place,
right.
But let's say for fun, they're concentrated in Irvine, California. And they might have been, in real life, they might have been a quarter of them might have been in Irvine, California. Well, actually, that's enough. If the pile of, if a quarter of them went bad, then the first loss, the weakest of the bonds, the riskiest of the bonds would go bad. But the point is that, all right, so let's say these homeowners start to default. So someone who owns the bond is out. There's a loss there. But then there's also, in addition, 50 times the losses. But it's not losses. It's 50 times a transfer, a zero-sum bet that's going to happen. That someone's going to lose 50 times that amount, and someone's going to make 50 times that amount. And it creates enormous instability in the financial system.
And this goes back to the question of what you said, how crazy it was to think that this is what they needed to create certainty. This is what it was originally, right?
Yeah, well, yes,
the original premise was...
I was completely buffaloed by this because actually when I left the Wall Street, it was, I think, generally true that the derivatives that were created were more likely to be used to distribute the risk intelligently than to do crazy things. and I lost touch with it. I mean, one of the things that draws me back is I can't believe that the Wall Street firms have gotten themselves into this position of doing such stupid things with money. And one of the big stupid things they did was get into these side bets that they didn't evaluate properly.
Right. Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break here at the halfway point. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Michael Lewis, the best-selling author of Liar's Poker, The Blind Side, many others, and we're talking about his newest, The Big Short, the story of some of the people, but through the story of those people, he tells us the story of the crash.
This is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my April 2010 interview with Michael Lewis about his number one bestseller on the financial crash, The Big Short.
We are in the thick of, whatever your disclaimers were about being able to explain this stuff, it's going great.
But, the minute I leave, you'll forget. The minute I leave, you'll think, I thought I understood that. No, I don't.
Well, that's probably what an awful lot of this was based
on. No, I'm creating the same sort of illusion Wall Street created.
Exactly.
I'm doing it for you.
So why did they end up needing this new thing, a collateralized debt obligation? We're making these side bets in the trillions on credit default
swaps. There are two kinds. This is where you have to, it gets even more complicated than just a collateralized debt obligation. But a CDO, a collateralized debt obligation, exists to take the weakest, the riskiest tranches of the bonds that are created. The first losses that come into the subprime mortgage pools are experienced by the triple B rated, the lowest rated bonds that come off the pool, and they're bonds that go bad if the pools experience, say, 8% losses, tiny
right.
losses.
Right, as you were putting out,
some of these pools lost 40% and 50% in the.
But that's
end.
Just if 8 out of your 100 loans default.
Or it'd probably be 16 out of your 100 because you have a house to sell and you get 50 cents on the dollar back. But so 16 of the 100 loans default.
And by the way, let me just remind people: it doesn't mean foreclosure. Right? It just means when the person who is making those monthly payments
stops making them.
Yeah. So as soon as the value of their house drops, or they've been refiing two or three times.
Well, once they default on their loan, those losses start to get experienced.
Yeah.
Well, so the question is, the hardest to sell parts of these subprime mortgage bonds are the riskiest. The ones that are stamped, 80% of these pools would be stamped AAA by Moody's or Standard & Poor's, and those are very easily disposed of to investors around the world who just bought blindly anything that was AAA that had a little higher interest rate attached to it. So, but these bonds that go bad when the first loans start to default, they're harder to sell. However, this is an amazing contraption.
It is.
You can take 100 different triple B rated bonds, pile them all up in another trust. It's called a collateralized debt obligation, And using the argument that they aren't all the same thing, that they aren't likely to all go bad together, that they're as diversified, say, as the original pool of loans.
That these diversified bad loans
these
are
diversified
as good,
bad loans, when effectively
are as diversified as yes, the good loans.
They're effectively all the same thing, we've now learned. But this rate, everybody pretended they weren't. And so they 80% of those will be stamped, rubber stamped, AAA. Now, there was a huge amount of money to be made buying up high interest, high yielding triple B rated bonds, tossing them into another pile and selling them off, 80% of them off as low yielding, you know, at much higher priced triple A bonds. So, so this is where it gets really creepy. There actually weren't enough subprime borrowers in America to satisfy the demand for those triple B rated bonds by the collateralized debt obligation.
Now let's remind people what you just said.
Okay.
So these bonds that should be so bad that nobody wants them,
once they're laundered, essentially laundered through this thing called a CDO, a collateralized debt obligation, now become 80% of them get rated triple A.
Now demand exceeds supply.
And so Wall Street starts to synthesize them because they can't find – they simply can't generate the loans fast enough to meet the demand.
And as much as we know that they were going in and they were saying, here, just sign here. You don't have to give us anything. You don't have to show us your income. You don't have to do anything. If you can just spell your name, you got a loan. Even then, at a certain point, they couldn't keep up with the demand.
They couldn't – this the demand – that's right. Actually, in 2005, at a very specific point, the middle of 2005 the first big so-called synthetic CDOs are created. Now this is where it's kind of mind-bending. It's not intuitive. It took me a while to completely believe this happened. When I buy from you, say you're Goldman Sachs now, all right? You're going to sell me a credit default swap on a subprime mortgage bond, on a triple B rated subprime mortgage bond. When I have identified me the smart hedge fund manager. I've identified it as this thing that, you know, I'm pretty sure it's going to go bad. So buying this insurance from you is going to pay off.
Right. He's buying insurance on the bond.
I'm buying insurance.
He's betting that insurance is going to pay off because the bond is going to fail.
Right. And you're selling me this insurance. When I pay you these premiums, the premiums actually mimic track pretty precisely the yields on the triple B rated bonds. And so the cash flows they replicate and the risk too. So if the bond in the real world goes kaboom and is worthless, the lender are out all your money. The credit default seller are out that similar sum of money, and the credit default swap buyer is, you can almost think of him as being the person who's making the home interest payments, the high subprime mortgage home interest payments, and so what Wall Street did was create CDOs that had nothing in them but credit default swaps. And you didn't need the loans. All you needed was people who were willing to buy credit default swaps on the loans, and you could replicate the loans. And of course, the people who are buying the credit default swaps are buying them on the absolute worst of the loans. So thus are born, they call synthetic CDOs, based on the absolute worst loans made. And these get rubber stamped 80% AAA rated bonds on the other side. And so this is why there was such a feverish traffic in credit default swaps, because Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and Merrill Lynch was the biggest, if they could find someone who would buy $1 billion of insurance of credit default swaps on a subprime mortgage bond, they could quickly turn it around into seemingly gold-plated securities that they could sell off to investors. It's breathtaking.
It is.
Is it not? Yeah. It is not, because in fact,
you can tell by looking at my face, it's like I've even read this and I've talked to the people and so on. And still, as we go through it, it's dumbfounding.
It's dumbfounding because when you this the financial system is supposed to be, its job is to allocate capital, and the way it does it intelligently is by making risks transparent, so you can they can be properly evaluated and priced, so the money goes where it's supposed to go at the right price. What the financial system evolved into was into a machine for disguising the risk, for camouflaging it.
Laundering, camouflaging.
For laundering credit, for taking bad.
Hiding.
And you think about our society, and it really is a response to, I mean, it's a peculiar dysfunctional response to the need for people to borrow money who can't afford to repay it, right? So there's obviously a huge demand for loans from people who will never repay those loans. If you can find a way to facilitate that without taking the actual risk yourself, you can make a lot of money. And so this is what happened. This credit laundering machine got built, this machine for disguising the risk of these loans. And again, the punchline is the people who built the machine ended up being deceived by it.
What Michael Lewis means by that is not just that they didn't know, but that they ended investing their own money. We said at the top that one of the problems was that they would bet against their customers. Well, but then they started making stupid bets with that money against their customers. Well, they got invested in the crap they produced.
That's right. They were that all the losses, the vast majority of the losses you see revealed in 2008 on Wall Street were losses in these particular securities. And the stories of individual traders have metaphoric power. And the one that I tell in the book that I found was just like perfectly encapsulated the madness.
The one who was the superstar until...
There's a guy at Morgan Stanley. His name is Howie Hubler, who is identified in mid-2000s as this really star subprime mortgage bond trader. They're paying him many millions of dollars a year. He's making many millions of dollars a year for the firm. The market's just going up, and he owns a lot of the market. They're afraid he's going to leave, quit to go for somewhere else for more money. So to prevent him from leaving, they give him his own, it's called a proprietary trading account. So he's now making big bets on behalf of the firm and not dealing with the customers at all. And he has this very convoluted bet that he thinks is in fact a bet against the subprime mortgage market, but he's betting. He's paying essentially insurance premium, and he doesn't like the fact that he's losing money paying out these premiums.
In other words, just so people know, that the one thing about this is you will pay the premium until something changes. So until the bond defaults and so on. So I mean, one of your main characters, and Michael Burry, he ends up having to stop his investors
from taking their money back
because he can stay in these insurance policies. People also in this crazy time have gotten used to being able to move quickly.
Right.
And the one thing about this one is you are going to pay that premium, low as it may be, for the chance at that huge payoff, but you're going to have to pay it for a while.
Right. So Howie Hubler has got this bet on. He starts his proprietary trading account with a few other traders in mid-2006, and he decides he gets greedy. He doesn't want
impatient to...
Impatient
and greedy.
And so he thinks, well, I'll just sell some credit default swaps on the better subprime mortgage bonds. But he sells them on AAA, supposedly AAA rated CDOs backed by subprime mortgage bonds.
But if anyone should know.
Anybody should know that basically they're all the same. He should. And in a matter of really just a few weeks, and this shows you how frantic the risk creation is. He essentially buys $15 billion worth of subprime mortgage bonds, and that are going to be worth zero within 9 months. And he loses $9.4 billion for Morgan Stanley, which I think is the single biggest loss by an individual trader in the history of Wall Street. And he did it on a single bet without the CEO fully understanding what on earth he'd done. It's poetic because he's one of the people who helps to sort of fix this market. He's in at the ground floor of sort of, you know, teaching ratings agencies how to rate bonds. And Morgan Stanley is very involved in all this. So if anybody should know that these that a AAA rated CDO backed by subprime mortgage loans isn't actually AAA. It's him, but he doesn't know. And
Let's does he really not know?
Does something crazy happen? It's why he doesn't know.
Is it bipolar behavior where they just cannot, you know?
This is what happens, that he's sort of incentivized not to know because he gets paid a big chunk of his running seeming profits. So he's essentially incentivized to sell catastrophe insurance because he will take the premium home at the end of the year. And if the disaster happens 3 or 4 years out, well, the firm's going to be sunk, but he'll have taken all that money home. And that's what happened. He took home tens of millions of dollars. In fact, was allowed to resign with tens of millions of dollars of deferred compensation. And even as $9-something billion is lost by the firm. So they are, I believe, and everybody who dealt with him believed, that he sincerely, his judgment was distorted. And this is the story of this era. It's a story of financial people having their judgment distorted by bad incentives.
Yeah.
And the question now is how to fix the incentives.
Right. Yeah, we've got about 10 minutes.
We're still not telling the story.
No. I don't think this was boring, but maybe I turn out to be more of a nerd than I thought. Because I mean, I understand it better than I ever have before. But let's do two things quickly. One is you didn't tell the story this way. As Michael Lewis said, I have forced him to reverse engineer all the wonderful information that he wrapped up in these character-driven stories in The Big Short, which is his gift, and made him explain the sort of all the MacGuffins,
right?
In a way.
That's right.
But go back for those and tell us just a little bit about the characters you found.
All right, so here's what you need.
And then in the last few minutes, we'll talk about the reforms we both agree on.
Here's the thrust of the story, that the financial system over a period of a few years, from 2004 to 2008, organized itself around a gigantic bet. And the vast majority of people in the system were betting on the subprime mortgage market, whether they knew it or not. And that includes all the big Wall Street firms, all the insiders. And there were, it turned out, a very small number of investors, more than 10, fewer than 20, who took the other side of that bet, who proved to be right, who were diagnosing the problems in the financial system as they were growing, were screaming at the top of their lungs about it, and were at the same time making a bet against the big Wall Street firms, and these characters, I essentially did a casting search and I went and got to know most of them and picked the few who I thought could best teach the reader about what happened. But they were all generally, outsiders maybe too strong a word, peripheral though, small time, oddballs, people often who were socially dysfunctional. They weren't clubbable.
As smart as they were, and it turned out they were very smart, they did not quite fit in.
They didn't fit in.
So they weren't in the ranks of these companies.
That's right.
Lippmann is in Deutsche Bank.
There's one trader at Deutsche Bank named Greg Lippmann who's on the right side. But he's the most hated man in Deutsche Bank.
There you go.
And so he's socially at odds with his environment.
The others are folks who for one reason or another are outside the inside club.
That's right. And they don't by and large know each other. But by and large they are in this very strange role of sane men in an insane world. That they are all a little insane in the bargain, too, makes it even more curious.
Yeah, as he points out, one has Asperger's. One just can't keep from insulting people.
Yes, they all have these odd traits that
contribute to why they're not in the club.
That's right. There are reasons they're not in the club. And they're also, but this was the core of my interest, was that it became pretty clear to me as I got to know these people that their decision to be betting essentially on the collapse of the financial system was deeply rooted in their character and experience of life. And so you had to understand who they were to understand what they did. And I hadn't thought much about the investment business, oddly. I mean, managing money's never really interested me. It surprised me to think, but it was obviously true in retrospect. I mean, I should have thought it was obvious, but it surprised me that these decisions were so deeply rooted in who a person was.
Mm.
But they are. They're big-time decisions made under stress.
I mean, it's interesting, actually, that as someone who really functions in the world of narrative, not in the world of investment,
right?
One would say, you know, things are character-driven. Things are character-quirk-driven and so on. And it turned out that the reality was truer than you even thought.
Yes. So I didn't – I had not even suspected it, really. I kind of thought, well – this investment business is largely an intellectual exercise and that people have their theories and they move on. But truth is, that's true. But it begs the question, where do the theories come from? And the theories often come from who they are. And so I had this collection of oddballs who were wonderful characters who each of whom, and this was the other point, each of whom had some quality or some perception that enabled them to see the truth. Enable them to arrange the facts that were available to everybody to arrange into the accurate picture of reality. And the point of them, it became pretty obvious to me, was that those traits that they had were absent from the system, and their absence was what drove the problem, that the system had ceased to tolerate these particular traits, these particular attitudes to the world, opinions, theories.
Let me ask a quick question. You have said in other interviews that the Wild West of the financial world, which you left in the 80s, which you wrote about in Liar's Poker, had been cleansed in a way. It had become much more a conformist, go by the book, where, you know, and that what you're saying is that these folks who saw through the crap that the system was making up were the ones who were shoved out.
Yes.
As it became more conformist?
And Greg Lippman, for example, at Deutsche Bank, everybody who meets him thinks this guy's a throwback to the 80s, and he just doesn't belong here. He talks about how much money he makes. He's insultingly blunt. He's, you know, obviously self-interested.
Now,
we all learn to hide this stuff.
What's interesting to me, as I remember when I saw that moment in an interview, is that so the Wild West culture created the junk bonds and all that stuff in the 80s.
Yeah.
The conformist culture created the credit default swaps and the you know, collateral debt obligations. It seems like no matter what the personality or the culture is, they end up in this
different problems. What happened in the last 5 years was so much more of a catastrophe than what happened in the 80s. What happened in the 80s, there was actual criminal excess in the 80s, right?
There were outlaws.
Yes. but you know, the junk bond market was in moderation. Is an incredibly socially useful
That's right.
market.
Well, as we were saying, most of these are introduced with a socially positive.
And the mortgage bond market, as it in its 80s incarnation, was incredibly socially useful. But it was dreamed up by people who seemed unsocializable. That they were wild and woolly characters, and as the system learned to flush the characters out. In order to avoid scrutiny, in order to avoid media attention,
it's right.
flushed with
we,
it all kinds of traits.
We behave nicer so that people won't suspect us of other things.
Right, because what we're doing is actually so awful.
Wow.
You know, I think that's the truth of Wall Street, that essentially on the surface became much more socialized, much more conformist. So on the surface, much more welcoming of women, though it wasn't actually all that welcoming of women. It wasn't all white anymore. It welcomed minority.
Uh-huh.
So it conformed to certain social norms, but the financial obscenity below the surface just got worse and worse and worse.
Wow.
It was a little bad in the 80s. It's a lot worse now.
Let me just say what I've heard you say are the reforms, and just add to them if you want. One is you can't, as a big investment bank, bet against your customers. Two, the risky stuff has to be transparent. You can't have these off-the-books things. Three, the ratings agencies can't have the incentive of being paid by the people whose stuff they're rating.
I would add your first point. It's actually – my point is that I don't think a Wall Street firm should be allowed to make any sort of bet on a stock or a bond when it's advising customers to buy this, those
the
stocks
same bond
or any so that you should that there should be firms that are trading shops and there should be Schwab.
And this is the Volcker rule if it really goes
this
in?
This is a slightly more extreme version of the Volcker rule. I think that there's a kind of new Glass-Steagall Act waiting to happen, and it is to divide the risk-taking from the advisory. And that it makes no one has explained to me why it should be okay for the firms to make bets for themselves when they're trying to sell the customer on the same stuff.
Yep.
Because it creates a natural conflict.
Obviously.
And it ends badly. And this, you know, that's one
when
of those.
It, when it really gets going, it can end really badly.
Yeah.
And then not taking. I mean, a lot of these things were invented and flourished because they were unregulated
because
and
they
off
were,
the books.
Off the books because they're essentially bilateral agreements.
And what you say about that is not just that, well, by sort of nature, it's intuitively, you know, that's bad. It's that it means the uncertainty is what makes things really precarious. When Lehman's in trouble, we don't know
what
why
it means.
They're in trouble.
We don't know
what it means for the other banks.
Right.
And if they were more transparent, we would be at all at less risk. The system would be at less risk.
Well, if people weren't allowed to make side bets with Lehman Brothers, if everything had to go through an exchange of some sort or a clearinghouse, then it would be the clearinghouse that would know exactly what Lehman's bets were, and the regulators could see it. And it would be the clearinghouse that have the responsibility of dealing with whatever losses came in from those bets. But you wouldn't be sitting there thinking, oh, my God, is Goldman Sachs this exposed to Lehman Brothers? Is
right.
Morgan Stanley?
Right.
Everybody wouldn't. They're now in a death grip. But they want to be in a death
they
grip.
They do because the uncertainty helps them since we bail them out.
Yes.
You know, just we're going to wrap it up. Originally, they were betting some of their own money. Then they were betting their shareholders' money, and now they're betting taxpayers' money.
That's
and
right.
There's no reason that anything we've done so far is going to rein them in. And in fact, I mean, the headline from just yesterday was that the hedge fund manager's money is the biggest it's ever been. There's things going on. It has gotten just as crazy as it ever was. Again, the new book, I highly recommend it, The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine by Michael Lewis. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly either at iTunes or at terrencemcnally.net. You can also find podcasts, articles, transcripts, and so on there. If you want to receive my weekly email telling you who's going to be on what we're going to talk about, email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, or you can also do that at terrencemcnally.net. This program will also be archived for the next 90 days at kpfk.org. Check audio archives, scroll down by date and time. Thank you to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi and Mark Maxwell in production, Matt Perez in traffic, and you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week. Thank you, Michael Lewis. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.